The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 21st of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up today, we're in Japan to take the temperature of an important relationship for the Indo-Pacific region. Our Asia editor is standing by.
Hi Tom, I'm Fiona Wilson in Tokyo. We'll be unpacking a crucial meeting between US President Joe Biden and Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, and we'll be talking about why it matters to the rest of us.
More from Fiona on the way in just a moment. Also ahead today, our correspondent Alexei Korolev tells us why Austria could become the first European nation to make COVID jabs compulsory.
Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer, who recently had COVID himself, said the vaccine mandate is not about pitting the vaccinated against the unvaccinated. It's about what we know with certainty, he said, and that is that vaccines present our best way out of the pandemic.
Andrew Muller is also on hand to unpack the last 7 days and will remember the life and music of Brazilian icon Elsa Suarez, who's died at the age of 91. All that ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. US President Joe Biden is meeting the new Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida today. The virtual bilateral talks are focused on the two countries' economies, climate and security matters. This relationship, of course, is key to the stability of the broader Indo-Pacific region. Well, let's get more on this now with Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Good evening to you, Fiona, there. I hope we find you well. What have we learned so far about the talks?
Hi, Tom. You know, they've already been saying at the White House, and Japan's also been pretty much giving an outline of what the talks will be. I mean, much to Prime Minister Kishida's disappointment, it's not a real-life meeting. It's a virtual meeting online. He was really hoping to be in Washington for this first proper meeting. They did bump elbows, COP26, but this is the first discussion, really real kind of policy discussion. I think security will be top of the agenda. It's always China, Taiwan, North Korea. Yeah, they're going to be touching, I think, on climate change, COVID. I think it's going to be pretty broad-ranging, actually.
Yeah, and that's perhaps understandable given, Kishida relatively fresh in office. Maybe instructive, Fiona, just to take a step back and consider the state, I suppose, of the broader relationship between the two. Obviously, we've had a number of resets post-Trump and now Kishida, of course, also. How would you gauge where the sort of the US-Japan relationship kind of sits right now?
Yeah, I mean, they're both reiterating this point about the US-Japan alliance being the cornerstone of stability in the region and the world as they bring it out to the world. And, you know, I think that's felt on both sides. Japan's absolutely critical to the US in this region. And, you know, for Japan's defense, there's a lot of talk in Japan about the harsh security situation that Japan finds itself in. You know, I mean, it's surrounded by, it's got North Korea and China. Obviously, these are the two countries they're most worried about. So that relationship is incredibly important. I mean, you have to remember that Fumio Kishida is very experienced on foreign policy. You know, he was a very long-standing foreign minister for Japan. So he's very seasoned in these meetings. He should be a safe pair of hands, but they're absolutely playing up this meeting. It's really, really important for Japan.
Yeah, and presumably Kishida's aware of how important it is for the domestic audience. Do you think that there's any kind of disconnect between what the expectations are from, you know, Kishida, his cabinet and so forth, and what the public expectation is? I mean, how I don't know, from people you even talk to, Fiona, how's this meeting itself perceived by the Japanese, this sort of man and woman in the street?
Yeah, I think people want to see reassurances from the states that they will be there. You know, this security alliance, very important treaty. In the treaty, Article 5 is the critical one that the US will come to Japan's aid if territories that it administers are under attack. And by that, it's really referring to these islands that China is also eyeing up in the East China Sea. So that's important. I think it's reassuring for people also on the matter of North Korea. I mean, we've had 4 missile tests already this year. So obviously, it has people a little bit jittery. So it's important to know that the Americans are supporting Japan. And, you know, it cuts both ways. It really is. It's important. I think there's a lot of talk about how, you know, Japan and the US, there's a lot about shared values and being aligned on, you know, a free and open Indo-Pacific. We hear that a lot. So I think this is very important. Also, you've got the Quad, which involves Australia and India. So you've got the 4 big kind of major democracies in this bit of the world all clubbing together. And it's really it's a sort of a barrier against China. And China knows that. So it's a source of contention. But this is interesting times in this region.
Yeah. And Fiona, one thing I find really interesting is sort of exploring whether traditional diplomacy and the traditional ways of doing these meetings, obviously adapted for pandemic times, but there's something traditional about it. Is that still fit for purpose? Because a lot of talk is about the disruptive nature of the interventions that, of course, Beijing makes or acquiesces to. North Korea, you've already mentioned missile launches and so forth. And there are so many players or proxy players who are using newer tactics. You know, that's changed because of the rise of digital. It's changed because of the way that countries engage with one another. Japan and the US, particularly under the current leadership, have made a big play of restating the traditional virtues of diplomacy. And it is maybe a little old-fashioned. Is it still fit for purpose? Is that a narrative, do you think, that people are interested in?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Tom. I mean, I think people saw under Donald Trump that he was the biggest disruptor, I would say. You know, he really upended, say, with North Korea. He thought he could go there and, you know, become friends with Kim Jong-un and would stop the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. You know, it was a very naive kind of approach. And I think people here realized that they had to go along with it because of the importance of this Japan-US alliance. I'm sure it's extremely painful for diplomats. And I think there is a bit of a reset to these traditional, look, the people who kind of think along the same lines, let's make sure everyone, you know, knows that we're together. You know, you don't want within this group people sort of arguing with each other. It's difficult. I think nobody really knows what to do with North Korea. North Korea is just the most remarkable kind of survivor, really. And it, as so far, no approach has made any difference. And whatever Donald Trump thought, you know, you now have this increased, this hurtling towards nuclearization that North Korea is pursuing. And it's very difficult to stop it. And I think, you know, that really they're prepared to try what it takes. But I think you're right. They're going back to more sort of old-fashioned tactics. And, you know, I think really it seems to have worked in the past. It is true that digitalization has changed things and social media is a big, big issue. And I think maybe Japan's been a little bit slow on that. What they'd like is they want a solid show of support from the US. And I think that cuts both ways.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Fiona, always great to hear from you. Thanks for joining us on the programme today. That was Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson. Now, with news of more US diplomacy and the day's other news headlines, here's Marcus Hippie.
Thanks very much, Tom. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov are holding talks in Geneva today as fears that Russia could be about to invade Ukraine continue to grow. Russia has 100,000 troops at the border but denies planning to invade. Mr. Blinken warned of grave consequences if Moscow's forces crossed the border. Germany's coalition government wants to attract 400,000 qualified workers from abroad each year to tackle both a demographic imbalance and labour shortages in key sectors. Berlin's new leaders fear the shortfall risks are undermining the recovery from the pandemic. In Italy, legislators are promoting a tax incentive known as the Superbonus 110% in hopes of improving the country's green credentials. The stimulus will help citizens make energy efficiency improvements to buildings, but you can find out why architects are concerned about it at monocle.com/minute. And finally, Elsa Soares, one of Brazil's great singers, has died at her home in Rio de Janeiro. She was 91. The queen of Brazilian samba released more than 30 albums in a career that spanned six decades. We'll have more on her life and legacy a bit later in the programme. Those are the day's headlines. Now back to you, Tom.
Thank you very much indeed, Marcus. 9 minutes past the hour here in London, 1309 in Vienna. And we head to Austria now, which has moved a step closer to introducing compulsory vaccination after Parliament's lower house voted in favour of new proposals. The move would make Austria the first European country to introduce mandatory jabs. Monocle's Vienna correspondent Alexei Korolev reports on the mood on the ground.
These were the scenes just a few weeks ago when Vienna saw some of the biggest anti-vaccine protests in Europe. Unlike in the Netherlands, they were largely peaceful, but the anger was real.
Wir als Bundesregierung, die Expertinnen und Experten auch in GECKO, nehmen diese Ängste sehr ernst.
The government says it understands people's concerns, but its position remains firm and resolute.
Es geht nicht um den Kampf Geimpfte gegen Ungeimpfte.
Speaking earlier this week, Austrian Chancellor Karl Nehammer, who recently had COVID himself, said the vaccine mandate is not about pitting the vaccinated against the unvaccinated. It's about what we know with certainty, he said, and that is that vaccines present our best way out of the pandemic.
Impfen der beste Garant dafür ist, dass wir gemeinsam als eine Gesellschaft in Freiheit leben können.
And today, as Austria passed 200,000 active cases for the first time, this is only too clear. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Thank you very much indeed, Alexei. Well, let's unpack this further now with Tessa Shishkovitz, UK correspondent for Profil magazine. Good afternoon to you, Tessa, and thanks for joining the programme. As Alexei said there, you know, pretty lots of anger, protests. They did stay peaceful, unlike the ones that Alexei alluded to in the Netherlands. But there was clearly a great deal of public, it was a divisive issue, and yet now a pretty aggressive approach from government. What do you make of it?
It's true that there is a lot of protests against the mandate, but look at the numbers. If you look at the boosters, 47% only of the Austrian population are boosted yet. That's not enough to curb the pandemic. You have at the moment Omicron racing through Austria. There are 200,000 active cases, as we heard just before, but that's a very high number. For Austria, there are daily infections that are still going up around 30,000. They couldn't even get the numbers out yet, the correct ones today, because the authorities are overloaded. So there is a case to say that you need to find a solution for this because people just don't do it voluntarily. And if you want to kickstart the economy and have no further lockdowns, Austria needs to do something.
Well, yeah, and I find it interesting. It's almost a paradox, perhaps, that a country where people are pretty reticent about the kinds of restrictions we've seen, and we've had, what, four nationwide lockdowns, I think I'm right in saying, in Austria to date already, that people need to understand that in order to safeguard certain liberties they hold dear, they may need to compromise on others. Do you think that we have reached a tipping point maybe amongst the public that there has to be compromise?
Well, the interesting thing is, and that's very important, I think, to understand why they came to this mandate now. In the early stages of the pandemic, Austria protected its citizens very well. The death rate of COVID is much lower than, for example, in the UK. If you think there are now close to 14,000 people have died of COVID in Austria in the entire pandemic, that is almost half in relative terms to the UK numbers. And so at the beginning, people were very well protected. Not so many people died. So not so many people thought that the vaccine was necessary to protect them. Also, there's not a lot of immunization among those who are among the population because not so many people got sick. And that's why in the summer, when the previous Austrian Prime Minister Sebastian Kurz said the pandemic is over, nobody went to go get the vaccine anymore. Not enough people did. And that's why they got to this point now. My feeling is that we had a few of these cases in Austria before where rather authoritarian measures were taken. People do follow them in the end. You know, the protests are there, but in the end, people will get a vaccine because, A, there are also these positive incentives now with the lottery, which is quite fun. You can get like 500 euros to spend in restaurants and in shops in Austria. If you're being selected, every 10th person who gets a vaccine or has gotten a vaccine or will get a vaccine is eligible for that. And so there's a mixed bag now of authoritarian measures, which are a bit uncomfortable, but also positive incentives. And so in the end, I hope that people will get the booster because the situation in Austria at the moment is dire.
Indeed. And what about the formalities that are attendant here, Tessa? Because essentially, once this lower house has passed this bill, it's basically going to happen, isn't it? And we already have set out quite detailed structures in terms of fines for people who don't then get their vaccinations once it's been mandated. If you challenge that and lose the case, the maximum fines are significant, you know, into the thousands of euros. Do you think that there'll be a great adherence to that aspect of the regulation as well once we get to March or whenever this becomes active?
Well, we'll see how it actually is playing out. But the fines, so the mandate starts in February. The fines will start in the middle of March. In these 6 weeks, I'm pretty confident that a lot of people actually will get follow sort of the letters they get from the health authorities to get the vaccine. If you don't, it's still not so clear, I mean, how severely this is being followed up then. And until you end up at 3,600 euros, it's a long way to go. You know, the rate is 600, but it also depends on your age and on your income if you have to pay the full amount. It's a little bit like paying parking tickets in London. If you're fast enough, then you pay less. And I think that people will actually be willing to get fined for something that, you know, a vaccine is something you get for free. They could also say like, okay, now is the moment when I go have my vaccine because I have no other way out. And usually in Austria, all these things are being followed, you know, and I think, you know, it's a bit more drastic than here, but I think we have to still keep in mind that Austria protects its citizens quite well throughout this pandemic. So if that's the only way out, I think the acceptance in the population will be higher than it looks now.
Tessa, thank you very much indeed, as always. That was Tessa Szyszkowitz from Profil magazine, their UK correspondent. Before that, we heard from Monocle's Vienna correspondent, Alexei Korolev. You're listening to The Briefing. Where it is now time to join Monocle's contributing editor Andrew Muller for his roundup of the week's weird and wonderful news.
We learned this week of an interesting codicil to the legal maxim ignorantia juris non excusat, which, as an accomplished Latin scholar like the United Kingdom's Prime Minister as of this recording will recognise, translates as ignorance of the law excuses not. We learned that it turns out that ignorance of the law actually excuses quite a lot, as long as you wrote the law yourself.
No, nobody told me that what we were doing was, as you say, against the rules, that the event in question was something that we were going to do something that wasn't a work event. And, you know, as I said in the House of Commons, when I went out into that garden, I thought that I was attending a work event.
We learned in week two of what has become known as Partygate that a scepticism remained at large that Boris Johnson was completely oblivious to the possibility that various soirees, wassails and wingdings at Downing Street these last couple of years had been in breach of COVID-19 protocols. Rules and restrictions about which Johnson might have been supposed to have known something, though perhaps he just doesn't watch a lot of television, or listen to much radio, or read many newspapers, or do any work. Can someone give the Venger Boys a tenner from petty cash? And pass me, if you would, the studio gong mallet. Though, don't go too far, chaps. On current form, we'll need you back next week. Not like they've got much else on, though. Anyway, we further learned that as Boris Johnson descended through the levels of political peril from merely embattled to actually beleaguered, his dwindling and inexplicable cohort of supporters inside Westminster were organising a counter-attack. And we learned that this enterprise had been given a code name, like in one of those World War II movies on which the Brexiter contingent have based literally their entire understanding of the world. We learned that the effort to rescue the Prime Minister from the Prime Minister had been dubbed Operation Save Big Dog. Although at this point we reckon there may be one more revelation about a lockdown cocktail evening from it having to be hastily rebadged as Operation Trip to the Vet, followed by Operation Tell the Kids He's Gone to Live on a Nice Farm. And just while we're up this way, we learned, thanks to the Evening Standard, who ploughed through the pertinent records, that around the time Boris Johnson was attending the party he now claims not to have known he shouldn't have attended, one London woman who popped round to a neighbour's house to deliver a birthday card and stayed for an outdoor drink was charged with breaking lockdown rules and told the court she didn't do so intentionally. She was convicted and fined £250 and was very far from being the only such example. Continuing with our research into COVID-19-related malfeasance, we learned that lockdown was perhaps especially rough on the lovelorn. We learned that during the spring of 2021, one Manchester man, deprived of the option of offering dinner and a movie, attempted to impress the object of his affections by detonating a firework on Marsden Moor, without subjecting his plans to the always crucial "what could possibly go wrong" test. We learned this week that at least one British judge reckons the value of 285 hectares of incinerated countryside at 12 months in the clink, and are therefore eagerly anticipating leaked reports of a Downing Street barbecue which got out of hand but which has been hushed up until now. But mostly this whole bit has been an excuse to play Cornfield Ablaze by Prefab Sprout. You took a match to my From 2001's The Gunman and Other Stories, a wretchedly underrated album, can I get some general muttered agreement? Actually, are the Wenger boys still here? They can't have anywhere else to be. And they're Dutch or something, right? That's a living, I guess. Because we learned that the Dutch had located some picturesque loopholes in the Netherlands' ongoing lockdown, which may, who knows, be of eventual interest to Boris Johnson. Under current restrictions, such venues as theatres, museums and auditoria are not allowed to open, but beauticians, hairdressers and gymnasiums are. We learned that several of the Netherlands' higher-profile arts institutions had protested this apparent inconsistency by combining column A with column B to pleasingly ludicrous effect. So, for e.g., the Limburg's Museum hosted a Zumba class, which is the kind of thing they probably play Wenger Boys tracks at. Mallet. And call them a cab, they've earned it. We learned that the Van Gogh Museum invited a couple of nail artists to set up shop, having presumably decided that ear piercers would be overselling it, and that the Royal Concertgebouw had a couple of hairdressers on stage while they soared through Charles Ives' Symphony No. 2. But come on, Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber was right there. Maybe these highfalutin fancy pants Dutch cultural custodians are not such clever clogs. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
You are back with The Briefing here on Monocle 24. Andrew Muller closing out to a chorus of boos. He's used to that after his programmes. It is 24 minutes past midday here in London. It's 9:24 in Rio de Janeiro. And finally on today's programme, we are heading to Brazil, which is mourning the loss of one of the country's greatest singers, Elsa Soares, who's died at the age of 91. To assess her extraordinary legacy, I'm delighted to say, we're joined in the studio now by a couple more of Monocle's own Brazilians, researcher Carol Albert Galvão and our senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Carol, Faye, thanks for being with us. Before we hear from you and some of your recollections, we're going to start with a little taster of what Elsa sounded like, in case there are any uninitiated listeners around the world. Here's one of her earlier hits. Amazing stuff, Fernando. I guess an amazing testimony is like everybody starts moving as soon
exactly.
as you hear it, which
what
is
a
extraordinary.
Voice.
But give us a little bit of just the relevance of Elsa Soares to the whole of the Brazilian music scene, because it's decades of a huge influence.
I mean, she is incredibly influential. And, you know, she's not only a music legend. I would say she is a Brazilian legend. Not everyone can reach this level. You know, and her life, I mean, it's incredible, Tom. I mean, she had a very tragic life in many ways. She was born in poverty in Rio de Janeiro. She was forced to marry at 12. She had her first kid when she was only 13. But even with that difficult life, I mean, this is the song that we just heard. That's from the 50s. That's one of her first big hits as well. So it's incredible that she remained a creative till the end. In fact, 2 days before she died, she was still actually kind of working on a special DVD, which I'm sure will be out soon. So she never lost kind of that creative side to her. And as Carol would agree, I mean, what a shock to everyone. The mayor of Rio declared, you know, for 3 days, you know, kind of, you know, it's been a really, really big story in Brazil.
Oh, yeah. And Carol, let me ask you about that, because I gather you had the pleasure of interviewing her pretty recently, just I think, now probably 2 years ago, but very recently. Yeah. What was that like? Because this is one of these things, right? You're meeting a true icon, I guess.
It was amazing. And I mean, I still remember that day so well, actually. And I've been thinking about it even more in the last couple hours. You know, I was just sitting there. It was still very much mid-pandemic. And I was just sitting there in my room interviewing her on Zoom. But it just felt so surreal because, you know, it was just this cloudy day in London. I think it was raining, it was horrible, but then I open up Zoom and here's this like luminous, wonderful presence and this amazing woman that I've been listening to my entire life. And you know, she's everything that Faye said she is. You know, she's an icon really, and you know, you can really sense that talking to her. She was 90 then, but she just has this youthful, like, just amazing spirit.
Mm. And you can, it is that thing, the sunshine courses into your headphones, it courses out of the speakers, it's extraordinary. Faye, you mentioned national icon, a hero. I always desperately try and shoehorn a shameless football allusion or reference. And of course, she had a long relationship with Garrincha, the little bird, one of the great footballers of all time. And again, it was a turbulent relationship, also touched with tragedy. He had his demons and addictions and problems, and they had a number of children, I think one of whom died when he was very young. So more heartbreak. But that relationship with Garrincha, which I know she mourned his loss very, very profoundly, but it shows how enmeshed with so much of the international image of Brazil she was woven into the fabric of the country.
Even though they had a turbulent relationship, you know, we've seen all the details in the press, but she loved him very much. Mm. And she had a very difficult few years after when he died. And it's interesting, Tom, that a lot of people in the Brazilian press are reporting Garrincha died exactly 39 years. So they both died in the same day. And some people, you know, they're finding meanings into that because she still loved him very much. As well. And just picking up what Carol was saying, that when she interviewed Elsa about the luminous presence, I actually had the opportunity as well to see Elsa here at Midori House, Tom. Not many people know that. We don't actually have the audio, unfortunately, but she performed at the launch party of Monaco 24. And it was also my first week working here. And so I didn't have anything to do with bringing Elsa here. And I was like, what? What is Elsa Suarez doing at the launch party? It was quite surreal. I'll never forget that moment. And you see, I mean, she was, you know, I believe she was around 80 at the time. And even though she is in a wheelchair, but she, you know, she's very vain. She was wearing kind of a beautiful, colorful dress. And her voice, everybody was like, who is that woman, for those who don't know her? So that was a very magical moment here.
Well, you're very youthful looking, Fernando, still to this day. But there's an incredibly youthful looking yes. Fernando in the background of some of the pictures which you've shared with me today, exactly. which are amazing. I'm sorry our listeners can't see those as well. Carol, can you just reflect a little bit on, I guess, not just the space that she leaves behind, but the fact that it's already kind of been filled. Her influence, I guess, has prompted so many amazing other artists to get into music, and we'll continue to hear her sound because of her extraordinary long career and all these amazing records, but also because you'll be able to hear her in so many other artists, maybe even people who are kind of just starting out today, right?
Absolutely. And I think so many people see her as a reference. And, you know, I think even Elsa, she's had this super long career. And I think that what's so amazing about her is that she hasn't really stuck to doing the same thing over and over again. I think even speaking to her, she was just talking about this constantly. She always wanted to reinvent herself, and she always wanted to work with younger artists as well. And not only, so she's not only just an influence, I think she actually knew these people. She knows the young generation of Brazilian artists that's coming up now, and she supported them as well, not just by being an influence, but by actually working with them.
Fernando, just as a final point, and we are going to hear a little bit more from Elsa in just a moment. Is it a question of, you know, national treasures? Can somebody step into those sparkly shoes? Can somebody fill this void, or will it take a whole huge cast of characters to try and deliver for the country and for a public that's mourning, as you said, national mourning declared practically in your homeland? Will it take a cast of hundreds to fill the void that she leaves behind?
It will take time, Tom. And you know what? This expression, national treasure, I'm sure you would agree with me, I only use when it really means. Because these days people say, oh, she or he is a national treasure. I mean, but Elsa Suarez was a national treasure, and I don't think there's a replacement. I don't think we're seeing the new Elsa Suarez. But as Carol was saying, there's so many artists influenced by her. And my favorite thing about Elsa, she never stopped working. She's a creative. And even she started as a samba singer, but, you know, she said, you know, I'm not just a samba singer. I want to play other genres as well. And I think that's so brilliant. And that's why people get influenced by her as well.
Absolutely.
Well, Fernando and Carol, thank you so much for sharing your memories. That was part of Monocle's Brazilian contingent. Carol Albert Gavao and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, looking back on the extraordinary life and career of Elsa Suarez, from whom we'll hear more in just a moment. Here she comes as I speak. And that does bring the curtain down on today's edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Carlotta Ribello and Rhys James. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett. Our studio manager was Nora Hull. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. But that's all from me, Tom Edwards. Playing us out, I'll leave you with the great Elsa Suarez. Thanks for listening.
Meu choro não é nada além de carnaval.